You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hello and welcome to the Guidepost, another episode. This time, it's the Bayou edition. I got myself, Bailey Short here, and Mario Campo joining me, talking a little bit more about Louisiana redfish. And as it would be appropriate for a Bayou edition, we might get a little spicy today on this episode, but we're going to try to keep it mostly on topic and professional. But Mario, I know I feel like I've been hearing wind of you actually working a lot on some striper stuff lately, huh?
Yeah. Getting a little involved with the East Coast crew over there. We got two new members of ASGA, two new consultants. We got John Carlucci and Jake Hardy that joined the crew. John and I, we've been working together on some striped bass stock assessment work together, which has been fun. And you know, that's one of the reasons this has been, you know, so enjoyable is being from Louisiana, working in Louisiana. You know, you're still able to you know, venture out and learn about different fisheries, mm-hmm. and you know, operate alongside, you know, others from other, you know, colleagues from other universities and other working groups. And it's fun, you know, it's an opportunity to learn from one another, help one another, and, you know, share what we love to do with, you know, members of the community and just broaden the impact and hopefully promote some more good. But yeah, John and I, we've been,
nerding out together.
Yeah. John's been awesome. Yeah. I've learned a lot from him and, we've had a lot of great conversations. So,
I was enjoying the text conversation. One of the group texts I was in with you guys, talking about that redfish stock assessment data and just seeing how quickly you two get into the weeds with the technical, you know, jargon and stuff. It's like, man, there's so much to this, this fishery science stuff. And it is really cool, with ASGA, we can kind of all, like me as a guide that, you know, didn't know a lot about this stuff when I first started about 4 years ago. And then like you as a hardcore, you know, trained biologist, it's really cool to have the dual perspectives. And those stripers are pretty cool. When I was up at Woods Hole a few years ago, speaking at the symposium with ASGA, I got to fish for a day out there in Cape Cod, and it was really fun. It's a cool fish. They're aggressive. They eat real good, and it was fun watching them destroy some flies. So that is a cool fishery and a cool fish. It's cool you're getting to work with them over there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like you said, this, you know, being a part of ASGA, it's really cool because, you know, with my background, you know, being in academia, you're surrounded by, you know, technical applied science all the time. And then you branch out, you know, into the work of ASGA and you're able to see the policy side, mm-hmm. you know, of the world. And you really learn how important it is to be effective in communicating, you know, that research, you know, to decision makers, to members of the legislature, and even to just advocates in the community, so everybody can have a better understanding of, you know, what's going on, what is the best available science right now, and, you know, what, you know, how do we apply it? How do we need to go about it? You know, what needs to be applied? What needs our attention right now? And so that's, I tell people that all the time is, you know, you could do some of the best science ever, you know, from your experimental design, to your assumptions, your data analyses, everything that you do, you know, you could have the perfect samples, whatever it is, you could have the perfect science ever. But if you can't communicate it, then you're still at one step behind because, you know, it's one of the biggest parts of science is communication. And one of the biggest disconnects between science and policy is policy oftentimes demands this explicit answer from science. We saw that in the Louisiana Wildlife Commission meeting where I think it was Chairman Segrera called up Dr. Scott Rayborn from LGL Ecological Research Associates, who was the leaders for the Menhaden bycatch study. And he asked for an explicit answer based on the suggested results from that study. And I believe that was based on, bycatch and buffer zones and, you know, if one action or the other would influence this or that and the other. And, Dr. Rayborn was like, look, man, this is what the study suggests. This is what we know. This is what we tested. And you know, these are the limitations of our study and these are the assumptions of it. And this is what we can do moving forward. And I think that was, a very polarizing, situation where you were able to see that stark interaction between science research and policy decision-making where, you know, it's like, hey, you know, I wish I could give you something, but this is science. There's always going to be uncertainty. Especially in nature, there's always going to be uncertainty. There's always going to be some type of variation present.
Things we don't know.
Things that we don't know. Fish swim, fish move. It's like one of the funniest quotes I ever heard whenever I got going into fisheries was, fishery science is like counting trees, except the trees are invisible and they move, you know? So it's like people all the time be like, how the heck can you tell us how many fish are in there? And, you know, it's rocket science, man. So it's like, you know, science as a whole, you can't give these explicit answers. And especially in fishery science where, you know, there's so many assumptions associated with, you know, with whatever, you know, models that are being applied or, you know, the uncertainty that's associated with what you're doing. You know, it's like these explicit answers, they do not exist. You have suggestions. And like I said, that I thought that was one of the starkest, you know, cases where you saw that interaction right there. And so,
well, speaking of a like marriage of policy and science, and data, you know, like all things fishery policy, like you said, that's what it kind of comes down to. And we're seeing with HCR5, one of the things we've been talking about, and to anybody listening, I know you heard our podcast, I think it was episode 201, where we spoke about some of these Menhaden bills coming through the legislature, and we had HCR5, which is a House concurrent resolution by Representative Orgeron for killing bull redfish again. We got on the podcast and we all had some words. I came up with some fun nicknames for Mr. Orgeron and our Dr. Orgeron. And, you know, we kind of got on there and riffed on it. And then he jumped on the next podcast to kind of debate and talk about some of the points and some of the policy. And, you know, I appreciated the conversation we had with the guy, and I thought that was pretty cool. I will say, we're back here talking about HCR5 primarily, I think, today, Mario, in this episode. And, you know, I think we both talked the other day about how when you look at this from a scientific standpoint or a policy standpoint, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense on either side. And here we are doing something and watching this resolution kind of push right through, you know, the House Committee of Natural Resources, the Senate, and we're sitting here now kind of it with these concurrent resolutions. It actually doesn't even have to go to the governor's office. So once it passes through the Senate Natural Resource Committee and the Senate floor, it's a it goes forward, and then LDWF has to deal with it. And I think what I really want to kind of touch on, Mario, among a few points with this HCR5 thing, is just how the more you dig into this whole thing, it doesn't really make a lot of sense as to why they're doing this, why this is something we need as a state, why this is a good idea, period, for the fishery. And it really raises a lot of questions as to where is this coming from and how are we seeing the support for this resolution. You know, I mean, the first thing I kind of look at is in 2023, we had SCR 46, which is a Senate concurrent resolution, which was requesting protections for oversized redfish. This was 3 years ago. This is the Senate. It was a, I'm pretty sure it went unanimously, if not near unanimously, but it did pass, talking about we need to not kill bull redfish anymore. Around the same time, Representative Orgeron, who is the author of HCR 5, did a bill that he tried to get through the House, which was HB 576. It was for coastal exclusion zones with the Menhaden stuff. So we'll get to how the Menhaden and this and the regulations and everything ties itself together, exactly with what you were talking about, how there's no exact answer. But HB 576 a few years ago, again, by Orgeron, he's in the bill, the wording talks about, and we talked about this a little bit with him, which was that the spawning stock of redfish had declined enough, as evident in the stock assessment, that bull redfish needed, quote unquote, extra protection. This was language he used in his own bill a few years ago. And now he's trying to pass something to let a few redfish die. And, you know, Mario, I would love to hear some of the scientific reasons as to why you've pointed out that this doesn't really make a lot of sense, because I know you sent me some excellent work that you kind of did on that and what LDWF is already doing to get some of the data that, you know, we've heard this is going to help us collect.
Yeah, man, that's all great points. And, you know, one of the biggest, you know, glaring things to a lot of us throughout this legislative session was, you know, why is there a lack of conversation around this? And like I said, this, you know, this isn't to beat a dead horse, you know, where, you know, listeners or whoever could be like, oh, you've had this conversation about your CR5, you know, already, you know, I've had all the social media posts, the podcast, whatever. Look, this isn't about, you know, clout. This isn't about beating our chest, being like, look at us, you know, we're the only ones talking about this. It's genuinely asking like, hey, why are we the only ones talking about this? Because we were in that room. We were in that room in the House Committee of Natural Resources just a couple years ago, fighting for the first, you know, the updated, you know, regulations of red drum since 1988. You know, mm-hmm. We were in there volleying, you know, three fish creel limit, four fish creel limit, you know, what slot size we were doing from, you know, we went from a three fish creel limit, 18 to 24 inch slot size, no over slots, to then, you know, we somehow that got bounced back to a four fish, 18 to 27 inch, you know, regulations that went in place. But like I said, all that aside, I just mentioned that to say that, you know, just 2 years ago, there was an army in that room going to war for redfish and supporting the department. And, you know, I want to ask about that, because you saw every, you know, NGO in there, you saw every group in there, you had stakeholders from all over in there, you had people from all over the country in there, because of just how prolific Louisiana's red drum fishery is. And, you know, it's like now this House concurrent resolution that is proposing the harvest of, you know, bull red drum or, you know, for the sake of this conversation, the bull red drum is red drum over 27 inches. Yes, the reason that's, you know, important is because based on the relevant age growth curves to Louisiana's stocks, to Louisiana's red drum population specifically, we know that fishes, male and female, on average, whenever they are, you know, around that 27-inch size class range, they will become viable. They will become sexually mature. They'll be viable for reproduction. And so does that mean every 27-inch fish will be, you know, reproducing? No. You know, like they may, you know, their reproductive organs may be mature, but they may not actually reproduce until a year or two later, whenever they become, you know, 31, 32, 33 inches. That's why there's so many studies on reproductive dynamics, is trying to understand, you know, when these fish reproduce, how they reproduce. Do they, you know, why do some fish skip a year spawning? And these are all super important things because, you know, if you have so many fish that skip a season of spawning, then you violate the assumption of that you set for spawning stock biomass and spawning potential ratio. There's a lot that goes into it. And I don't, you know, mean, I don't say that to go off on a tangent here. I'm explaining why it is so nuanced and important to protect, these sexually mature fish, because the contributions that they have towards the resiliency and the longevity of this population.
Let's face it, like we said this back when we were looking at reducing the limit instead to three, we were cautioning Representative Orgeron, the Senate, the Commission, the Oversight Committee, the Joint Oversight Committee. We don't know what's going to happen in this, you know, 20 plus year rebuilding timeline. We had an absolute historical snow event, ice event, it's cold snap. We've had some, you know, small oil spills. We could have bad spawning years. And I think to the point you're making there is, you know, you really can't risk these large redfish when there's so much uncertainty in the spawn, in the resiliency, so on and so forth. And you start opening the door back up to harming this already damaged population. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense when we really haven't made a good decision to this point in managing these fish. Ever since that stock assessment come out, we did the bare minimum recommendation by the department biologist, essentially the bare minimum reduction. We didn't do anything else. Now we're putting bull redfish harvest back on the table, albeit in a, you know, a smaller, not statewide, but still, it opens the door. And, you know, I think what I'm hearing listening to you talk about this is just, you know, there's so much uncertainty to this and we're risking it once again. It's really, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Mario, you know, you wrote out some stuff to me texting about some of this stuff. And I just want to ask you this question. And if you can kind of like flesh this out, scientifically, you know, a lot of the rhetoric around HCR5 when Orgeron's gotten up there to promote this resolution in the Capitol has been about how, and he said this on our podcast, I would have liked to have discussed this a little bit more. He didn't really seem to have too much to say about this, but how important is it that we kill these bull redfish to collect scientific data that's actually relevant for us versus non-lethal methods?
It's one of those things where, you know, we know for a fact that these fish do not need, there does not need to be any lethal harvest of these fish to gain meaningful fishery dependent data. And I say fishery dependent implying that there is fishery independent data, which is true. So fishery dependent data, as the name implies, is that is dependent on the fishery itself. So you're gaining data from the recreational, or if there was a commercial fishery as there was in the past, you're gaining that data from the recreational or commercial fishery. Fishery independent data is gained from scientific sampling techniques, which is gathered from LDWF, which they do throughout their CSAs, their coastal study areas. They gather their independent data from, you know, their travel net surveys, their CMAP inshore bottom long line surveys, some mark recapture stuff. They also have a new novel method, which is they just got a few electrofishing boats that can handle marine environments. So that's really cool. So that just increases the resolution of fishery independent data even more. You're going to get some younger beer fish and all that. But anyways, I say all that to say, historically, when overslot redfish were allowed to be harvested, we were able to get a ton of age length data on those size class of fish. So you have a ton of, empirical data on this fish. You got, massive historical data or robust mm-hmm. historical data sets on these fishes. Now that the new regulations have come into play where, they're protected now, you're not able to harvest them, you're still getting that fishery independent data on these fishes. You know, they're still sampling these size classes across their various sampling techniques, which I believe they're based on, random stratification across the CSAs. They're sampled, frequently on their, on their long-term monitoring, framework. And I could go on and on about LDWF, and, I truly respect them, and I think they do quality science. They're led by some fantastic folks in the marine fisheries side that, have been, honestly great mentors to me. And like I said, I truly value and respect, the work that they do and their contributions to the state. So, I mean, what they're doing right now, is everything that they really can be doing. Like I said, on the fishery dependent side, and they got away from MRIP, which is NOAA's MRIP fishery dependent, framework. They got LCCREAL. So we have some of the highest resolution data on the fishery dependent and fishery independent side. So with all that being said, why do we need to kill bull reds to get some fishery dependent data? Well, that's because we know that there's no better way to age a fish than pull its otolith, or as people call their ear bone, the ear stone. Mm-hmm. They're these little calcium buildups or deposits that grow in the fish's head. And otoliths are really cool. You can look at seasonal growth with otoliths. You can look at their microchemistry. You can look at how the pretty much like the ontogenetic processes of this fish, or what areas this fish used throughout its life history. Otoliths are really awesome, but the downside of otoliths is you got to kill the fish to get it. So the trade-off here, as all things in fisheries are trade-offs, what do you do? When killing the fish isn't the best option, what do you do? And that is a pressing question that's, occurred all through the history of fishery science. For endangered species or for fisheries, for these species that have, protected size classes, due to effective regulations, harvest regulations that are put on them. It's like, how do you handle that? Well, there's ways that we can infer length from age and age from length. And those are what we call age length keys, mm-hmm. We have three types of age length keys. We have forward keys, which this is going to be a very elementary explanation to not put anybody.
Yes,
to sleep.
I think that's.
And this is going to be very straightforward. But you have this is a complete side note. But I'm currently in Natchez by the Mississippi River, recording this, and I'm pretty sure I'm looking at Britney Spears. I think Britney Spears is here walking down the sidewalk. Anyways, maybe she wants to hear about this. But anyways, so you have three age length keys, okay? You have Ford keys, which they describe the probability of age given size, okay? And then, funny enough, you have what we call inverse keys, which is the complete inverse of that. That describes the probability of size given age. Well, both of those methods, okay, both of those methods have their limitations, and they have their own assumptions that are associated with them. So say that, you know, you have a fishery where you have some type of data gaps, or you have some limited ability to collect data, whether it be age or length, whatever. They have a new age length key that was developed that's called combined Ford inverse age length keys, which is simply the coupling of both of these concepts using a maximum likelihood framework. So in the Ford keys and the inverse keys, you have what we call binning, where you have this stratification of age and lengths, but the combined Ford inverse age length, you're able, it doesn't require every year class, you know, to have these associated ages to be fully observed, but rather it estimates this smooth probabilistic age length relationship through time. So right now, since 2002, LDWF has used seasonal age length keys, and that is a framework that is extremely close, and it's actually related through Bayes' theorem, but we're not going to talk about that, to Ford inverse age length keys, okay? So they've used this empirical seasonal inverse age length key framework, which you can, you know, which is referenced from the most recent Red Drum stock assessment. And it models that age growth model is based on the Ford derived age length keys. But yeah, so, you know, the big reason that we're talking about Ford inverse age length keys so much, as I mentioned, it's able to handle, you know, these gaps, in data, whether it be temporal gaps in data or be, you know, gaps from age data or length data, because it's using the capabilities of, you know, your forward model derived age length keys, as well as your inverse age length keys. And that's extremely similar to what LDWF applies. They use what it's called seasonal age length keys. They've done that since 2002. They use these seasonal inverse age length keys and for areas that may be data limited in size and age classes, as well as some temporal gaps, they're able to inform that framework with their model-based forward-derived age length keys. So as I mentioned, they have seasonal inverse age length keys and model-derived forward age length keys. So as that implies, the usage of inverse and forward is a type of combined age length keys, very similar to this Ford inverse age length keys that I was talking about. Very often in stock assessments and other applications, they use a multinomial logistic regression. But you can also use Bayesian inference for this as well, where you're able to inform the model with priors. But one of the most important things, and where a lot of pieces of literature fall short in the application of really any quantitative technique, is the lack of reporting of assumptions and limitations and uncertainties. So, you know, where this Ford inverse age length key framework is strong, it is so important to be able to still come forward and say, hey, this is its limitations. This is what its assumptions are. One of the biggest things that people often contest with it, and contest, you know, this entire scenario where they're saying, you know, species like Red Drum it, you know, this species has a very broad asymptotic mean length. So whenever you think of isomtote, which is where, you know, asymptotic is derived, that is where a curve is flattening out. So for red drum, after their exponential growth, and where their growth starts to slow, those size age classes have a lot of overlap in them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of, you know, a big question mark is, you know, how, you know, if you just get length data, how are you able to decipher, you know, or infer, you know, what is the probabilistic age to this length? But luckily, you know, like I said, without getting into the weeds of this, that is where this forward inverse age length key framework shines, is it's able to give you a quality probabilistic age length relationship, especially in this scenario where we have robust fisheries dependent data, especially the fact that we have, you know, a robust empirical data set for this now protected range of age classes for bull reds.
So
we also have the ongoing independent data as well.
So unless these fish start changing the way that they grow and the rate at which they grow, we've got a pretty good indication of a way we can model these things and get some age length associations and kind of get the same thing that more or less we'd be getting from killing them. And, you know, that's where, again, I find myself so disappointed with the language of this House Concurrent Resolution 5, because there is no, we're talking about all these scientific ways to circumvent killing these bull redfish in the name of science, which is what Orgeron has gotten up on the podium and spoken about and kind of used as justification for this thing. There's actually no explicit wording or mandate or provision or anything in there about in the concurrent resolution as written about how these fish must be used for data. And, you know, no one's really questioned that. We questioned him a little bit on it on the podcast. I understand, you know, Representative Orgeron's had some conversations. I don't think he's lying about that. I think that he truly believes that that's what these fish will be used for. I remember a similar conservation issue recently where things didn't go as planned and a bunch of people got out and started saying we had a deal and you wronged us. And I just don't see why we don't make a more galvanized and clear plan. If we're going to kill redfish, if we're going to increase the level of uncertainty to the future of these redfish, because they're already hurt. We know that. They've already been dealt with a massive cold snap recently that we don't know a lot about the effects of. I don't know why we're even considering killing bull redfish right now and introducing even more uncertainty and more potential timeline for the rebuild of this fishery when they're so fragile at this stage. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me logically where we are at this point, especially when you see what the state legislation has already said in the recent years about bull redfish, how they need more protection. They are a weakened stock, as evident by the stock assessment. You know, we should not be killing bull redfish, but I guess it's okay if a few people, you know, run some tournaments and kill some bull redfish. I think that is such a slippery slope to get into when we're already in a really weakened spot. I'm really just shocked that this concurrent resolution thus far is actually, I don't even think there's been an opposing vote on the House floor to this thing or on the committee. I might be wrong about the committee, but there certainly wasn't on the House floor. And I'm sitting here wondering, Mario, who called in a favor is a question that comes to my mind. Who down in Grand Isle or wherever it may be called in a favor with, you know, the governor or certain representatives or senators or whatever, and got this thing to just fly right through? Because it starts to feel that way when you look at the decisions that the state has made around bull redfish, the rhetoric the state has used around bull redfish when it comes to menhaden regulation, and the fact that let's just be completely transparent. I haven't seen a word about this from CCA or LWF. They've been covering in detail
explain the last one so there's no confusion between
LWF, Louisiana Wildlife Federation, not LDWF. It's the Wildlife Wildlife Foundation, which is another, nonprofit type deal. They've been both partnered up on this Menhaden House bills, AIS, the fines going up to 5,000, and to use Orgeron's own words from our last podcast, the ridiculous bill of data transparency. I'm happy that one's going through. Orgeron called it ridiculous. That's not me trying to throw shade. Just using the verbiage that he used. We're hearing all about those three. And concurrently, you have HCR 5 going through legislation, and not a word has been said. I have a lot of respect for Representative Orgeron for getting on the podcast and hashing it out with us. I thought that was incredible, and I would welcome him to jump on anytime. But I'm also, out of that respect, not going to keep quiet and not critique decisions that I see being made on the state level, especially when, Mario, you've mentioned this to me multiple times in the past week. You know, the state biologists and the department, LDWF, has an excellent group of biologists, great data, a commission set up that set a precedent to be like more cautious with the redfish stock than the state is. And here comes state legislation overreaching and getting involved with this stuff once again.
Yeah, man, that's pretty much a story across every, it doesn't matter what state you go to, or if you're at the state level or the federal level, very much so how I touched on it earlier in this podcast is that you have that bridge that you have to connect between, your science and your policy. I don't know if it got lost in a technical difficulty we had earlier.
Let's be real. You were talking to Britney Spears, but go on.
Yeah. I think it really was her. But anyways, the Louisiana Department of Wildlife staff is absolutely incredible. We have the utmost respect for them. Their marine fishery staff is A+. They truly care about the work they do and have done some significant positive contributions to the state of Louisiana and its resources. I have the utmost respect for them. I support their work. In this case here, it's being said that, this bill is going to get data for them to do better science. And you think back to everything that we just covered and you're saying, well, you think you going to get a couple of otoliths, over a a very narrow, time frame in a very narrow spatial area is going to help one of the best state agencies in the country do better science? I mean, that's a slap in the face to those guys who, I mean, we're talking about the same state agency. We're talking about the same marine fisheries division that developed their own fisheries dependent framework that they're selling to other states to do better science, to get away from NOAA's IMRA. Like, we're talking about literally one of the best marine fisheries divisions in the entire country.
And that's where, for me, I'm listening to you say these things, and as a lifelong guide in this state, if you want to do a good thing for redfish, stop frickin' killing them. Period.
I mean, how much more do we need to give up? We went from the, we had it to the finish line a couple of years ago when regulations were being discussed. We had the, you know, an 18 to 24 inch slot limit for three fish, I believe. Can you check me on that? That's correct, right? 18 to 24 inches, no fish over, three fish creel limit. That was about to go through, and that would have been a 55%. That would have been a 55% yield reductions of juvenile fish, and that would have put us on a much accelerated recovery timeline for spawning potential ratio and escapement rates.
And you know, I just have to jump in on that and say this. This is where it all ties in for me. Back then, myself, Ty, Tony and Cody, and everybody ASGA en masse flew down to the state capitol. We testified on this, and we spoke about the uncertainty, how you're trying to throw a Hail Mary all the way down that football field to the next generation of anglers and hope that there's redfish left with this, you know, it's like a 32-year-long timeline we're talking about, which show me science that can project anything 32 years
from now. Which is based on what I mentioned, the 55%, you know, would have been a 55% yield reduction.
Yeah, then we'd be at 16.
I misspoke on that. Let's see. Yeah, no, it would have still been a 55% there, but now we went from a proposed, you know, would have been a 55% estimated yield reduction to a 36.9%. So, I mean, in the terms of years, I mean, you just gave up over 16. A decade. Yeah, you gave up over a decade and a half of recovery timeline. You know, with that, and I want to say this from the wetlands side of thing, Louisiana is the epicenter of coastal habitat loss. Since 1932, over 1.5 million acres of coastal habitat has gone away. You can find that in various USGS studies, but you know, much of that coastal habitat degradation has occurred within estuaries. And so whenever we think about estuarine-dependent species, such as red drum, spotted sea trout, Atlantic menhaden, in their early life stages are heavily dependent on habitat availability and habitat quality of these estuaries. You know, why are we putting all of our eggs in one basket trying to say, we think things in 20 years are going to be the same as things today, whenever we see that we've already lost over a million acres of this critical coastal habitat?
Well, you want to know what the most disturbing part about that to me? The most disturbing thing about that to me is this. When we died on that hill of going from three fish to four fish over the uncertainty of nature, the uncertainty of the future of the fishery, et cetera, et cetera. You want to know the most uncertain thing that we didn't realize at the time? How quickly this state, how quickly these legislators would turn around and try to start killing bull redfish again.
Unanimously is the word, right? Because we've seen with the Gulf menhaden, discussions, you know, everybody wants to post about it. Everybody's on the social medias about it. People are going to all these other podcasts doing all this, you know, but for this House concurrent resolution that puts redfish at stake again, puts bull redfish at stake again, it unanimously passed every single step.
Went right of through the legislative House
process. Right, you know, up to this point, it hasn't been heard in the Senate yet, but it went through the House unscathed. There was not a single nay. There was not a single nay on it.
There wasn't even a lot of question. Yep.
There, you know, and it was like there hasn't been. We haven't seen a podcast on it. We haven't seen a social media post on it. We haven't even had people ask about it because people don't even know about it. And it's concerning to me because, you know, we have one of the directors of one of these, you know, prominent organizations in Louisiana that had a very significant spot to propose information in the Senate and made the remark that they didn't even want to be there. So if they didn't even want to be there for one of the most, you know, from one of the most pressing, you know, legislative topics, you know, for this session, you know, how are we going to expect them to step up to the bat for something like this House concurrent resolution whenever
exactly.
these are some of the same groups that actually lobbied for the more liberal regulations to take place for the Red Drum regulation several years ago. So how can we assume that these quote unquote conservation efforts are really to support the resilient longevity of these resources rather than, hey, look at me, come do this, come do that. We're saving the
100% world. 100%, Mario. And, you know, that's where I get fiery and I get, you know, loud and start yelling on these podcasts with you guys, because nothing upsets me more than the absolute conclusion that I come to every time we have these discussions, that redfish, bull redfish, the redfish population at large is being used as a political bargaining chip. Once again, it's being played the political game with, and the loser of that is obviously the redfish, but the generations of fishermen to come in the state of Louisiana. That is the loser in this game when we do this. And we've done it for my entire lifetime. We've done it for your entire lifetime. And we're showing no signs of stopping unless somebody, some association, gets up and starts talking a little bit about how disturbing this is, how quickly things change, and everybody's memory seems to be really, really, really short down there. I don't know if it's something with all the refineries burn off, but nobody seems to be able to remember what the hell people are voting on 2-3 years ago and then spin around and do something different. So I think, Mario, we covered this really well. I think there was some really good science. The length key stuff was just spot on. And as somebody that's not my natural world, to hear you talk about that and explain it in a way that I can grasp it is really cool. And then when you look at the policy around this thing, it's nonsensical. The only answer that I can come up with is somebody called in a frickin' favor, and the loser of that is redfish and our next generation of fishermen here in Louisiana. And that's really disappointing. So,
and I want to say this too. You don't need a degree to talk about this stuff, to learn about it. You don't need to be a guide of 20 years to talk about this and care about this. You don't even need to be a part of an organization to talk about this and be a part of this.
You don't even need to be from this state.
You don't even need to be from this state. Like I said, I'm from Louisiana. I live in Louisiana, but we're equally as involved in matters from Maine to Texas, because we simply care about doing the right thing based on the best available science, you know, that's out there. And so, you know, if you're passionate about something, you know, take that time to learn it, dive into it. You know, have humility, ask questions, and learn. You know, knowledge is power here, and I think humility is just as powerful, especially in these circumstances. And you know, have conversations with people. I mean, you look at the members of the House, and you look at their main occupations. You're going to see some attorneys. You're going to see some, you know, owners of small businesses, some, you know, land developers, whatever, you know, and they're on the House of, you know, Natural Resources Committee. You know, they're the ones that are yay, saying yay or nay to, you know, decisions.
Yeah, they're making some of these decisions we're talking
decisions,
about.
Yeah, to decisions on work that has been done by people that have dedicated their entire lives and careers to you know, relevant science and management. Like a lot of the people that I mentioned with Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries, you know, you'll see that at, you know, in Florida with FWC, wherever you go, you will see that you have these people that grind day in, day out, all night long for years and years and years and spend their careers studying something and trying to advance it. And then, you know, when that proposition comes through or that recommendation comes through, you know, the people that are in charge of, you know, putting it through or sending it back, you know, they may be an attorney for their day job. They may
you don't know.
That's true. Construction business owner for their day job. And so that's not knocking them, especially as elected officials, but it's once again trying to emphasize why it is so important to communicate these issues from the science side to the policy side, and why it's so important to have advocates that truly care about the subject so that they emphasize and portray the passion and the support or support against or opposition to whatever it may be. You know, it's important to just get in front of them and explain to them, you know, what is going on, because, you know, we're talking about age length keys and this, that, and the other. It's like, you know, these people in the House may have never heard of that, likely never heard of that. I'm like, okay, that's cool, whatever. And it's like, you may have somebody that spent their whole life in trying to figure out which age length key is best for this. And so it's like, it's simply just getting in front of them and saying, hey guys, you know, I look, you may think you're trying to do the right thing with getting extra data, but it doesn't work like that. We have other ways to go about this, to apply this, and it's a win-win for everybody, especially in a world of trade-offs. And so, like I said, as gaining information and knowledge and growing advocates, it's so important to get in front of these committees and just voice your concern, voice your passion, your support or opposition to whatever it may be, because at the end of the day, you know, these elected officials, they have to go over so many topics of so many things. And we often forget that they're not experts at all of these things. And so we have to be the voice that carries the work of these people that have spent their careers to advance the resiliency and support the resiliency of these resources to get across that finish line and make sure that we have a better future, whatever it may be.
I hope some of these legislators listen to this podcast. I hope some of the Louisiana constituents listen to this podcast and reach out to their legislators and ask some of these questions and raise some of these points. And we'll certainly be doing that. We'll be testifying and emailing and making podcasts and yelling into the abyss and all of the above, because it's worth it to us. And we believe that this is important and these are topics worth talking about. So, Mario, I appreciate it. I think we covered a lot and really got some good stuff out there. And hopefully we'll be on here again soon complaining about a new, well, hopefully we won't be complaining. I'd like to have some victory lapping to do on here sometime, hey, but we'll do whatever needs be.
There's always light at the end of the tunnel somewhere.
Amen.
But one last comment, man. I know we always talk about we encourage people to show up to commission meetings. We encourage people to show up to, you know, the legislative sessions, you know, meetings. And, you know, one of the best things that you can do is look somebody in the eye and shake their hands. Form connections with these people. Ask relevant questions. If you go to a Wildlife and Fisheries Commission meeting and you see some of the, you know, you see a director or assistant director, biologist, whoever it may be, man, sometimes they are, you know, they haven't heard thank you in a long time from somebody of the public, because public perception a lot of times deteriorates around certain topics, especially whether it may be, you know, enforcing new regulations or whatever it may be. Man, just shake somebody's hand, look them in the eye, say, thanks for what you've done. I may not agree with it, or I may agree with it, whatever your feelings are. Ask a question, just ask about it and have them explain it to you so you have a better understanding. Because if this world is nothing without communication. And I want to support that. I want to promote that. And I think we would all be better for it if we all shook more hands and said thank you and asked more questions.
Well, take your own advice next time. And when you see Britney Spears walking down the sidewalk, go shake her hand.
Well, I'm newly engaged, so I had to make a
respectful admiration.
I had to make a game time. That was a game time decision.
I know you're Rico Suave, but you don't have to flirt with her. You can just introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, I could have.
All right. Well, thank you guys. And see you next time.